Hello, friends. Welcome to our Southern Community, your public affairs program exploring the people and the issues of the environment, energy, and economics in our region. Today's program is a visit with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and we are pleased to have Jennifer Renix, the Federal Policy Coordinator for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Jen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much, Ned.
It has been a while since we've had a chance to visit, and things have stayed interesting. In the last year or so, our conversation today is going to, I hope, cover a lot of ground. The Keystone Pipeline, tar sands in Canada, and our continued addiction to oil. How's that for a lot to talk about?
Sounds good.
Let us start off with the tar sands in Canada. It's quite a story, and there's a lot more to it that has kind of escaped the media radar.
It really has, Ned, because when people are thinking about where we get our sources of oil, one of the main considerations that people have had as of late is not wanting to import oil from countries run by foreign dictators or countries that are hostile to the United States. And so more and more, we've begun to look at our neighbors, Mexico and Canada. And while Canada might be a friendly nation state that we do business and trade with, their oil form is actually one of the dirtiest and one of the highest carbon fuel sources we have out there. Some people call it oil sands, but I believe in calling it tar sands for what it is. It is vast quantities of very low-grade oil. There are all kinds of properties mixed in with it. There's clay, sand, and you've got this very heavy, dark, dirty, viscous oil, and all of it is held under some of the most beautiful boreal forests that we have left in the world. So when we're going in there and we are pillaging to get to this oil, we are literally destroying the forests first. We are destroying whole watersheds in order to process it. And then this oil has to get shipped to whoever's going to use it. So there are myriad of problems that we have with this energy source.
We think of oil recovery, drilling, and so forth generally as, well, it oozes up out of the ground. You put it in barrels. Every once in a while, something goes wrong, like the BP Gulf disaster, which wipes out a region. But the process itself pales in comparison to the devastation that's happening on tens of thousands of acres in Canada right now.
That's correct. When we are looking at the process of mining tar sands oil, not only are we mining it, which we would be doing with most any oil well, but then the oil, it's extracted, then they have to go through a very water and energy intensive purpose called the separation. And then they have a nice euphemism called upgrading, where the product is taken and considerable amounts of energy and water are used to then produce energy. So it's not even a winning equation in terms of how we're getting this energy source. We are using a lot of energy to get to it. We are using vast amounts of water. And that part of the equation does not count for the destruction of the boreal forest, which I mentioned before. But there are really significant health and cultural impacts as well, because this is a poor region of Canada. You have very large tracts of Native people and reservations, and there is just vast destruction that is happening up there. Out of sight, out of mind, unfortunately. And for many people, it remains that way.
It seems there are many parallels to what's happening in Canada now, and I'm taken by your out of sight, out of mind comment, as compared to what's happening in the United States with mountaintop removal. Out of sight, out of mind, there's a disproportionate impact on the population, on the health. But just in terms of the sheer magnitude of the area, the tar sands devastation really dwarfs what we've seen so far with mountaintop removal. Is that a reasonable assessment?
We are seeing complete devastation of entire watersheds, which is exactly what we see here in Appalachia. We are seeing entire communities impacted to the degree that they cannot remain any longer, and that's exactly what we are beginning to see. There is a really interesting piece that the National Geographic did several years ago. It was March of 2009, and the piece was very aptly named. It was the Canadian oil boom, and they called it Scraping Bottom, because indeed, when all we have left is tar sands and oil shale in terms of recoverable or attempting to recover resources, we truly are scraping bottom. It is the dirtiest, it is costly, and that is all just in the mining and extraction and separation process. There is another very dark side of tar sands, and part of the reason why Southern Alliance for Clean Energy got involved, it is that tar sands oil have a very high carbon footprint. It is not a one-to-one ratio, whereas if you burn oil from the Gulf of Mexico or from the Persian Gulf, it would be approximately equivalent in terms of carbon pollution to tar sands oil. In fact, it's higher. It's anywhere from 1.5 to over 2 times higher in terms of the eventual global warming pollution that will be released. And so that is a true concern for us, apart from the environmental, the financial, and then the health and cultural impacts.
We'll come back to the greenhouse gases because there's interesting federal legislation that addressed that. But rolling back just a little bit, it just seems insane to try and be charitable to look at an energy source that, in essence, takes more energy to get it out than you get when you get it back again. And that's something that many Americans, many people just don't get. If it takes a gallon and a half of gas to get a gallon of gas, you just lost a half a gallon.
That's a good point, Ned. And we also see some similar negative equations when we're looking at some of the less sustainable biofuels out there. There are a lot of critiques about corn-based ethanol. And while every energy source has its limitations and drawbacks, you can look across the board and you can find a negative for almost any energy source out there. Some are going to have double and triple negatives. And in the case of tar sands and in the case of corn ethanol, you have environmental destruction, environmental impacts. But then if you are also having to invest as much or in some cases even more energy to get energy out, the only way it works is that dirty little word called subsidies. That's the only way that this becomes a profitable equation. And of course, it's profitable for the company extracting and mining. It's not necessarily profitable for the end consumers like you and me who someday may purchase this oil for our gas tanks.
So profits are trumping physics in this case, once again. Well, let us come back to the greenhouse gases that you mentioned, because that is really a huge part of the opposition to doing what's being done in the tar sands area and oil usage around the world. Isn't there existing legislation that essentially says the United States can't establish oil industry imports if there's a greater ratio of greenhouse gas emissions to the fuel coming in? Okay, I know I didn't quite get that right, so clarify it.
No, you're exactly right. A few years ago, under President George W. Bush, the United States Congress passed an energy bill in 2007. And there was a fairly minor provision called Section 526. And many of us wouldn't know or care about this section, but it has a very, very important provision. And it prohibits the federal use of any fuel that has a higher greenhouse gas life cycle than conventional petroleum. So if you are using a source that is going to put out more global warming pollution, it is against the law for the federal government to purchase and use that fuel source. And this was a law passed by bipartisan chambers of Congress, and it was signed by a Republican president. So there was support for this provision once upon a time. How quick we are to forget. Now there have been multiple attempts over the last few years to roll back this one provision. If, in fact, this very destructive Keystone Pipeline were to be permitted, it would actually be enticing the United States into breaking its own law.
The Keystone XL pipeline, which I think is the official name for it at this stage, is something that has been in the works for quite a while, but very much under the radar for nearly all Americans. It just hasn't gotten much media. But this is a pipeline that wants to take the processed tar sands and get it into the United States.
That's right. And this pipeline would run many thousands of miles. It would run from parts of Alberta in Canada, and it would come right down through the central United States, with the terminus being down in the Gulf of Mexico region. That, as I'm sure many people know, is where we do a lot of oil processing. We currently do. And one of the real concerns, including concerns by members of Congress, is that this pipeline would come right through a very important aquifer that many people have probably heard of, the Ogallala Aquifer. You've got an aquifer that is supplying water to a large portion of the region, both for drinking as well as for agriculture. And you certainly got a lot of population concentration going, you know, more or less up and down this Mississippi River corridor. And that's more or less the route that this pipeline would take. There are sure to be environmental impacts along the way. One of the areas that Southern Alliance for Clean Energy has been getting more and more interested in over the years is the concept of disproportionate impacts. You have populations in the United States and in other parts of the world that are often disproportionately impacted in terms of health impacts and financial impacts from dirty energy choices. And so by routing this pipeline, you can guess it's not going to go through the wealthy neighborhoods. It's going to go through areas where there are already people being impacted, and this will be a further impact. So that is certainly a reason why we are concerned and why some leaders in Congress are as well.
It's going to take a lot of energy just to pump this oil down.
That's correct. In addition to the mining and the separation and the extraction and the upgrading, that is all simply to get it to a usable state, but you're going to have to get it up out of the ground, rip apart the boreal forest to get to it, and then you're going to have to pump it all that way. And as we've seen, certainly last summer, the BP disaster, we also saw some, quote, minor, unquote, spills happening up in Alaska. We've seen ones happening in Michigan along the Kalamazoo River. And now, as I'm sure you and many of your listeners are aware, we have an ongoing spill in the North Sea. We've seen multiple cases. This won't be, by any stretch of the imagination, an isolated case if we do have leaks along this pipeline.
It should be noted that the Shell leak in the North Sea off Scotland is, as we record, they finally publicly said there's two leaks. And so the early estimate of about 45,000 gallons spilled and 6,500 acres covered with oil is probably an early guesstimate. This all relates to this proposed pipeline because, as we know and history has shown, pipelines have leaks and accidents. There's a long litany of these problems in the Arctic with the Alaska pipeline that's been around for years. Shell is trying to drill in the Arctic and they can't do it in the North Sea, so how is it going to happen in the, you know, all these questions come up. So that the industry spin that the Keystone XL pipeline will not impact the environment is a pretty tough one to swallow.
Well, I would say it's laughable. I don't see how anyone with a straight face could tell us that they're going to be able to mine these very dirty tar sands, that they're going to be able to transport them, and then, of course, they have to refine them. And that process has been fraught with environmental difficulties for many years. There are parts of the Louisiana and Texas area, the bayous down there, a lot of areas are referred to. There's one in particular, Cancer Alley, where you've got very high environmental impacts. You've got very high human health impacts, and then the environmental impacts of water and plant and animal species as well. So there are many reasons why listeners should be concerned about the Keystone XL pipeline. One of the primary reasons that Southern Alliance for Clean Energy got involved in this, because people may think, well, what does the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy have to do with Canada? It is Southern Canada, but that's not much of a connection thousands of miles away. But one of the reasons why we got involved is the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy for some years has been tracking the growing issue of biofuels. We mentioned earlier, corn ethanol is a bit of a touchstone in this debate, and certainly there are people who line up on the pro and con of corn-based ethanol. But here in the United States, in the southeastern United States, we have a really strong potential for the realm known as cellulosic biofuels. And cellulosic ethanol is using more of the mass of the plant. And in many cases, it can be using what would be considered weeds or waste material in order to produce bioenergy. And we have some very strong potential here in the Southeast. And when we look at something like tar sands, that would crowd out some of this fledgling market that could be done well and could be done sustainably if given the right time and the right guidelines to move forward. And instead, we may have massive government subsidies going to support a very, very dirty and very polluting oil source. So we look at that as a real problem for our region.